This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
What's the one piece of advice that helped you or your loved one through life-threatening times? In the shadow of terminal illnesses or conditions, what have been the sayings or the philosophy or the people or the poetry that have helped you or the people in your life deal with existential crises? I'm Mary Guerin. This is The Conversation Hour. And yes, today we're contemplating some pretty big questions. That's because we're thinking about the amazing, life-affirming resilience exemplified by two men we're remembering today, Neil Danaher, whose big free slide will play out without him for the first time at the G in just a few hours. And also Richard Scollier, former Australian of the Year, who after a lifetime of service faced his own terminal diagnosis. He has died aged 59. One quote in all of the tributes to Richard Scollier jumped out at me today. It's from a yet-to-be-aired interview that Australian Story did with him. Here is his advice to all of us. Let me read it for you. Enjoy your life. Contribute to the things you're passionate about. Don't just lean in, leap in. That's how you can make a difference. Don't just lean in, leap in. The words of Richard Scollier. It's about as good a piece of advice as I've ever heard that we could hear any day. We all know the concept of memento mori. That's remember we could go at any time, so make the most of every moment. It's a great thing to think. Sometimes it's a hard to keep hold of. So I'd love to know from you, what thoughts have you or your loved ones lived by when facing the prospect of the end of life? I'd love to hear your stories and your thoughts. Let's pay tribute to Richard Scollier and share that conversation today. Also today, that's pretty deep. Let's also go shallow. The World Cup is this week, as we know, and so many of us have quite a shallow knowledge of the beautiful game. So we are here to help on The Conversation Hour. You're going to get a World Cup for Dummies breakdown. We are going to tell you how to make it sound like you know what you're talking about at barbies and parties over the next few weeks. You can't avoid it. It's going to be everywhere, that World Cup fever. You may as well. To quote Richard Scollier, it seems like he'd have a laugh and agree with this. We need to leap into that World Cup waffle. That is all coming up this hour. But next, we continue the tributes to Richard Scollier. And we also are asking you how to remember to live life to the fullest, even in the darkest times.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
So what is the one piece of advice that helped you or your loved one through life-threatening times? Give me a call, 1300 222 774. We are talking about this because we're talking about Richard Scollier. He is leaving behind a legacy of revolutionary brain cancer research, but also that was after a lifetime of being one of the world's top melanoma pathologists. John Thompson has known Richard Scollier for 30 years. He's former executive director of the Melanoma Institute. Currently, he's an emeritus professor at the University of Sydney. And he joins us now. Hi, John.
Good morning, Mary.
I'm so sorry for your loss. How did you get to know Richard and what did he come to mean to you?
Well, I think you've already summed up Richard pretty well. Make the most of every day, make the most of every moment. And that was the person I first met over 30 years ago, a young, enthusiastic pathology registrar at the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital in Sydney, who was clearly someone of enormous intellect, drive, enthusiasm, always asking questions. And that was Richard.
You say you met him at the very beginning of his career, and that attitude then that we're talking about, what is so extraordinary in the face of, you know, looming mortality, that was there from the beginning, that sense of joy every day.
Absolutely. And you know, that shone out from Richard. It was easy to underestimate him. He had, you know, an almost boyish demeanour, the lad from Launceston. But beneath that was an incredible mind, an incredible drive and determination to find things out and do things.
How much did he contribute in this melanoma field? How can you sum that up?
His contributions were enormous. I mean, not generally recognised is the fact that without much encouragement, he set up the world's biggest biospecimen bank for melanoma. Now, that may not seem much, and it's not very exciting to most people, but in fact, it allowed a lot of the research to happen that led to the development of breakthrough drugs in melanoma years later. The whole situation has changed. We now have immunotherapy agents that are incredibly effective in patients with advanced melanoma who would inevitably have died previously. So, you know, he was part of all that. The biospecimen bank allowed what we call translational research to occur that led to the development of these drugs. Mm. His pathology was, at world level. He was one of the world's top melanoma pathologists that enabled us to understand the disease better and treat it better. All these things.
There's such a legacy. You're listening to John Thompson, who knew Richard Scollier for 30 years, who is now Emeritus Professor at the University of Sydney. And then there was this extraordinary twist in the tale of his life, which is, of course, him getting the brain cancer and then using those techniques on himself. What did you think at the time? Did he come to you? Did he talk to you about it?
Absolutely. But really, he said, there's no question. He said, I'm a scientist. I'm a cancer researcher. This is untried, completely untried. It works in melanoma, but we have no idea if it works in brain cancer. It's risky, he said, but I'm prepared to take that risk in the hope that it pushes the field forward. And that's certainly what's happened.
Mm. Is there a memory of him that will stay with you, John?
many memories. Mm. I mean, he was a man of so many different talents. I mean, he was a mad triathlete. He was a swimmer. He was a fanatical park runner every week. It wasn't just about work. He was an all-round man. He was a family man, devoted to his family. One particular incident, I can't really remember, except when we visited a very important institution in Boston mm. on an official tour, and he came sort of dressed in shorts and a short-sleeved shirt, and he said, Richard, that's not really what you do at this esteemed establishment in Boston.
Ever the boy from Lonnie?
Absolutely.
John, thank you so much for joining us today. Really lovely to hear your reflections on him. And as I say, condolences. I think we're all trying to embrace a little bit of Richard Scollier's spirit today. I hope you can celebrate his life.
Thank you. Yes, he was one of my closest friends, and I think he leaves an amazing legacy to the nation.
That's John Thompson. Thank you for joining us. Former Executive Director of the Melanoma Institute and who is at the University of Sydney now. So I'd love to hear from you. If you have a story from your own life or that of your loved ones about the bits of advice, the philosophy, how you actually face life-threatening conditions, because we are inspired by Richard Scollier, not just his work, but his attitude right towards the end of his life. We are going to be joined soon by someone who's had a life-threatening diagnosis and can talk to us about that. But we wanted to hear again directly from Richard Scollier. This comes from the New Australian Story interview, actually filmed last year, but it hasn't aired yet. This is Richard Scollier reflecting on how he was looking at the end of his life.
I think I'm like many patients. No, you don't want to die. You love your life. I love my family. I love my kids. My friends. People I work with. I don't think many people would accept it until you get to a period where your life's miserable and you can't contribute in the same way, and that makes it very tough. But until you get to that stage, you want to be here enjoying life, contributing to it, and trying to make a difference. And that's what I've been doing for a long time, and yeah, obviously very proud of what we've done as a team to make such a difference.
That's Richard Scollier in an interview that will be in an Australian Story, a new Australian Story episode next Monday. Dr. Charlotte Totman is a clinical psychologist who specialises in cancer-related distress and has lived experience of breast cancer. She joins me now. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi, Mary.
Tell me, when you listen to those words of Richard Scollier, I guess from your perspective dealing with people, you know, is that common? We'd love to think that's how we're going to react to a life-threatening experience, but I'm not sure necessarily we know until we're in that spot.
It's certainly one of those things that you can't really predict how it's going to be until it does happen, and it is different for everybody. And Richard was, I think, unilaterally considered to be quite an extraordinary person, an extraordinary contributor, and he really did put into action that very strong, you know, sense of purpose and meaning and wanting to make a contribution that was very aligned with, I think, who he was and what his values were. And broadly, a sense of purpose and meaning and being able to, I guess, perhaps feel like you've left your mark on the world or left a legacy of some sort is sort of important to a lot of us, but it comes in very different forms.
Not all of us can reflect. In fact, very few of us can reflect on a legacy and a life like Richard Scollier had.
Indeed.
So how does one in that circumstance get that perspective that can help them look forward when you're looking forward, there is that looming sense of mortality?
Well, the first thing I would say, particularly on a day like today, and particularly to the people who might be feeling a bit triggered by this, who might be living with their own very acute mortality, is beware the comparisons. So it really is different for everybody, and what matters to you and what you derive purpose and meaning from is very individual. No judgment, no comparison. So that would be the first thing. The second thing is that sometimes I think people expect that they might have like a big epiphany, you know, like sort of like this big almost blinding, you know, awakening when they get a terminal cancer diagnosis and, you know, have a real sense of like, right, I know what I'm here for. I know what I want to do. And to be honest, that does happen. It does happen to a few people. For a lot of people, it's like there's a really big event, there's a really big batch of news, and then it's like, I've got to find a way to integrate this into the rest of my life. I've still got to pay the bills. I've still got to look after maybe my kids or my aging parents. I've still got to keep body and soul together. And maybe my purpose and meaning is much, much milder, much more modest, much smaller. And that's fine. That's okay. Being able to identify it can be really helpful. So for some people, it might be like, I want to give back. For some people, it might be, I want to make sure that I've really like left a very intentional legacy. So I want to make sure that I've captured parts of my life, maybe in writing or in photography or something like that. For some people, it's repair and rebuilding things that maybe they feel like they're not happy with, and they might have, you know, unfinished business they want to attend to.
You're listening to Dr. Charlotte Totman, who's a clinical psychologist who specialises in cancer-related distress. And Charlotte, also, you have shared your lived experience of breast cancer as well. How do you reflect on your response to that in light of everything you've said?
I certainly have had what I call almost a universal experience with all the clients that I see, which is a shift in perspective following my diagnosis 8 years ago. And to be clear, my diagnosis was early breast cancer. I was fortunate to have excellent treatment. I live with fear of recurrence, but I, at this point, am not facing, you know, a mortality situation. But I do live with fear of recurrence, and I certainly have changed my perspective in terms of what really does matter and what really doesn't. And I have been able to practice with greater motivation and greater clarity about focusing on the things that really do, really are important to me, and letting go of a whole lot of crap that isn't, and things that would have bent me out of shape in the decades past really don't now. And that's really kind of nice. And whilst there's not a lot that's good about cancer, I do feel like sometimes we can make lemonade out of lemons, and that's one way where you can actually go, okay, maybe this is an opportunity for a little bit of a shift, a little bit of a do-over, where we can maybe set aside or move on from or let go of maybe a whole bunch of stuff that really in the whole scheme of things just doesn't matter.
Yeah, because others who haven't gone through that experience, we can try and, you know, memento mori all we like and take advantage of the day. But then, you know, like the clothes washer breaks down and then all of a sudden it
all
gets too hard.
All the other stuff happens. And that's right. And you have to attend to that stuff. You can't live on like a cancer desert island where you go, I'm just going to look at everything through the cancer lens the whole time. I mean, at the very end of life, sure, that might be the only thing that you're confronted with and have time to focus on. But when you're living with an advanced cancer situation, it is very much a how do I integrate the cancer treatment, the side effects and the mortality awareness? How do I integrate that into life?
Mm. You're listening to The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne, Victoria. Charlotte, you've talked about also the difference between a life-threatening illness and a terminal illness in terms of attitude there. Mm. What sort of things can people with a terminal illness diagnosis face that's quite different?
I think, so in terms of one of the big emotions, which is fear, we, in the work that I do, which is called psycho-oncology, which is the cancer-related distress bit, we make the distinction often between fear of disease progression, which is something that people living with advanced cancer often experience. So it's the idea of like, we're not able to cure the disease, we are able to treat it, but it means that they are living with this awareness that as time passes, inevitably, and it can be a short time and hopefully it's more of a longer time, but that inevitably there will be disease progression, there will be treatment changes, there will be a narrowing of options. And living with that awareness that's pretty heavy. By contrast, people who live with more like an early cancer diagnosis, they live with fear of cancer recurrence. So they live with the fear of the cancer coming back. They're similar but different. And I guess the primary difference is that with the early cancer situation, it's a possibility that something might further happen. With the advanced cancer situation, it's a probability that something will happen. And so they're very heavy feelings to have to deal with. And, I mean, one of the big things that I highlight with clients, much I think to the frustration of some oncologists and surgeons, is that these feelings of fear, we don't get to get rid of them. They are lifelong. They are now part of our lived experience. It's almost like a gift with purchase when you get a diagnosis of cancer. You know, it's a gift with purchase you don't get to give back. And what we know from the psychological research is that these types of fears, they don't go away. They exist in the back blocks of your brain a lot of the time until they're triggered. And to be honest, a day like today will be triggering for a lot of people. They'll have mixed feelings. They'll have all of the admiration and shared grief around Richard's death, but they'll also have that spark and bringing into sharp focus the reality that cancer does take people's lives. And so the thing that I say is it's really important to acknowledge that and not to push that down or try and suppress that.
Yeah. And so for the rest of us, if we are friends and family or colleagues of someone going through this, what would be the bottom line of what we can do to support people who might be feeling that triggering today or just in general?
The best thing that you can do is listen. If somebody opens up to you, wants to be vulnerable with you and share their triggering experience or their fear on a day like today or any day, the very best thing you can do is sit in that puddle with them. Don't try and fix it. Don't try and move them on from it. Don't try and shake them out of it with a bit of what I call toxic positivity, which is like, you know, think on the bright side. Really allow them the space and the grace to sit with them and say, that must be so hard. You know, like I can't even imagine what that must be like, and just sit with them. And sometimes that's sitting very quietly in quite a lot of silence, and sometimes in the heavy, in the puddle. But that is an enormous gift to be able to do that. And if someone isn't offering up their vulnerability to you, but on a day like today where it's kind of everywhere, I mean, you've only got to open up any online resource at the moment, and Richard is everywhere, is to gently check in and say, how are you? Like, are you okay today? You know, do you want to have a chat? Or even a, you know, arm around the shoulder or an extra long hug where you just say, like, today might be quite tough, I suppose, for you.
Yeah.
And just that acknowledgement and validation, listening and validating, are so underrated and so underdone and so important.
Yeah. Shouldn't take these occasions to remind us about that, but Charlotte, it is always great to hear from you and to get those really important insights, especially on a day like today. Thank you.
Absolutely, Mary. My pleasure.
That's Dr. Charlotte Totman, who's a clinical psychologist specialising in cancer-related distress and has lived experience of breast cancer as well. You are on The Conversation Hour, and coming up soon, changing gears altogether, you're going to get a cheat sheet for the World Cup. It's beginning this week. You won't be able to get around it. How do you sound like you know what you're talking about if, like so many of us, you only dip into it every 4 years? But next, we have got also news about what we might be scanned for in our luggage. We know about weapons and drugs and so forth, but what about dried seahorses, shark fins and sea cucumbers? A breakthrough that's coming up next.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Wanted to bring you news from an Australian research team that's developed a detection tool to help catch marine wildlife trafficking in luggage using AI. The lead researcher in this team is wildlife scientist Dr. Vanessa Perotta, and she joins me now. Hi, Vanessa.
Hello, and happy World Oceans Day.
Happy World Oceans Today to you. So when people hear of wildlife trafficking, I don't think they generally think of sea cucumbers and so forth. I think of rhino horn or things like that. Why should we care about shark fins, sea cucumbers and seahorses in particular?
Well, that's a really good point, because people don't necessarily think, oh, is that a shark fin in your luggage? Or, sorry, but you've got a fish around your neck. That has actually happened. So, listeners, this sounds a bit extreme.
Fish around the neck?
Yeah, there has, and it's a very public one. I believe it was in Melbourne too. A gentleman had a fish around his neck in a bag. You name it, the illegal wildlife trade is a global problem. And generally, it's when people remove animals from the wild and they transport them across international borders. It's not good. It can be an economic problem for all of us, because we could introduce exotics into somewhere. It could transmit zoonosis, which we're all familiar with COVID, aren't we? And it generally, when it comes to marine life, people don't think that these creatures are being trafficked, but they are. And my team and I, and this is very collaborative, we've got Taronga Zoo, Rapid Scan Systems, the Australian Museum, the list goes on. And it's such a wonderful opportunity for us to use AI, or artificial intelligence, for good, and by no means of replacing jobs. This is a complementary tool that we present today in our latest research.
I can hear you're anticipating some questions there, Vanessa. Just before we get to the technology itself, these people, when they have these things, these people, travellers, when they have these things, are they in products that people innocently buy, or do people who have these things know what they're doing?
Most likely, it's and I say most likely because we don't have a complete snapshot of why people traffic wildlife. And generally, the deliberate and illegal movement of wildlife is alongside other criminal activity. So we're also talking about, you know, the movement of money and other big things like that. So they will most likely know they're doing it or get paid a lot of money to do just that. But Australia is one of the best places on earth when it comes to biosecurity and detection. And this is a collaborative project with the Australian federal government as well. We don't want to see our native animals go out of Australia or exotics come in. It's a bad thing.
One of the fascinating things about your project is that you point out it actually uses the technology that's already present in airports. So, as you say, not necessarily leading to, you know, fewer jobs and so forth. Does it also mean it could be rolled out relatively quickly?
Well, it could. So this is the big distinction here, everyone listening, is that this uses 3D tomography X-ray technology. So this means that if you've gone through the mail, or I should say the airport rather than going through the mail, but you can go through the mail. If you've gone through an airport scanner lately, you don't have to take your luggage, your laptop out of your bag. You might notice that. And that's because we're using 3D tomography. So this means we can look in and around an item. And that's super, super cool. Some parts of the world don't have this tech yet, so that's an economic bit of a challenge. But for places that do, like Australia and a few other places, well, many places, I should say, this technology can be placed on existing scanning machines to enable this to happen. So it's a watch this space scenario, but like with everything, it needs further investment so we can roll out these algorithms, so we can flick the switch on so they can be ready to detect.
You're listening to Dr. Vanessa Perotta, and she's from Macquarie University, and this is some more scanning that might be in your on your luggage as well. Vanessa, this is a pretty nefarious field, obviously. Won't criminals just make sure that they put it in different packages or conceal the products? Is there any way they can get around your technology?
That's true. Traffickers are quite clever, and by no means am I talking on behalf of people who do just that. I don't know how people operate, and only the information I provide is publicly available. So I'm sure there's some much more, much more thought out, sophisticated methods that people do this. But the thing is that we evolve just as traffickers evolve as well. So as we have people trafficking, they're likely to change how they do it. And so that means our tech can essentially keep up to date with that, as long as we keep providing it more info. So it's kind of like if you teach a computer to look for something, you teach it in the most simplest form and then you complicate the scenario, and then over time it gets better at looking for something. And that's why I've said it's very much a complementary tool, because you have people who are told by an algorithm, hey, there's something in there, or you have people who might see something and the algorithm doesn't. And that's why we still need humans to sit on those seats to help provide this complementary means of detection to stop out this activity.
Sounds like a great breakthrough, Vanessa. Happy Oceans Day. I hope you get to have a dip in the ocean to celebrate.
Thank you so much.
That's Dr. Vanessa Perotta, a marine scientist at Macquarie University. Coming up on the Conversation Hour, we're going to meet a former Royal Botanic Gardens boss who's also internationally renowned. He was born in the Mallee and he got a gong in the King's birthday gongs today. But coming up next, 1300 222 774, what are your questions about the World Cup? We're going to give you a World Cup guide for dummies, and that's a lot of us.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
World Cup fever is almost among us. For some people listening, of course, you're already deep into it, but a lot of us are just thinking, oh, how are we going to talk about this at parties? It's something that we're not going to be able to avoid for quite a few weeks. It starts within a few days. We thought we would give you a cheat sheet to the World Cup. So we have turned to soccer fanatic and sports researcher Dr. Andrew Ross from Victoria University. Thank you for joining us and teaching us all the ways of the beautiful game, Andrew.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Are you gripped by the fever yet?
Yeah, look, I'm as you stated, I'm a soccer fanatic, so it's starting to heat up for me at the moment. I've already been getting my diary in place for trying to watch as many games as possible.
Andrew, what are the basics we need to know in order to scrape by?
So this only happens once every 4 years. So this World Cup's in Canada, Mexico and the United States, set to be the biggest World Cup on record. So there's 48 teams this time around instead of the 32. So that's 12 groups of four, with an extra round of 32 now. So that's 104 games or matches across about a sort of just over 4 week period.
And what are the characteristics of where it's going to be hosted, and what might be the things that we drop into casual conversation about, oh, this World Cup's pretty warm? Would you say that?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. So the biggest World Cup on record and set to be the hottest World Cup as well. So this World Cup's combining heat, travel, even altitude and match congestion. So that would affect performance as well. So people watching the game for the first time may think, oh, this one's a little bit slower than normal. So and teams now will be getting a 3-minute cooling break in between the half. So it's actually in some ways more like AFL in some ways, where there's a quarter. So there'll be, you'll be four periods there. So
is that the first time that's happened in World Cup history?
Actually, interestingly, it did happen back in USA in 1994, so a long time back. There was heating breaks, but this is the first time in some time, which in some ways has had experts kind of a little bit worried about that with regards to heat stress. But those cooling breaks will help, and teams are already starting to arrive in the States and in Mexico to acclimatise.
This is your cheat sheet for the World Cup. Paul from East Melbourne, you had a question or a comment?
A comment.
Yes?
Yeah, hello. The only two words you need to know about the World Cup at the moment are Tim Payne. Now, people will ask, who's Tim Payne? Mm-hmm. Tim Payne is the least known footballer at the World Cup this year. An Argentine influencer went out and put his name on social media as we speak. He has over 5.3 million Instagram followers. He has songs written about him. He has interviews. Like, it just means that one of the least known footballers in the whole World Cup is now become the most known footballer in the World Cup.
It's so he plays for?
New Zealand,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's just,
what do the songs say?
Well, the songs are mostly in Spanish.
Okay.
But they have English translations, and they just talk about him as, you know, the GOAT. He's known as the GOAT of world football now. So it's interesting to see how, you know, social media puts, you know, just the average person in a spotlight.
That's so true. So your number one tip for things to drop into a party is, how about that Tim Payne? Anything else, Paul?
Oh, well, there's the football. There's the actual football side.
There's the actual football.
Yeah. And just
what do you reckon about the soccer? Is it have a chance?
Yeah, look, I'm hopeful. I suspect that we can get out of the first phase. I'm looking forward to see Iracunda, Volpati, and maybe, you know, Chakarti, a couple of really good guys. I think we can get a win and a draw to get out, and I'm really, really hopeful that we can do that.
Oh, Paul, thank you for those tips. Love that. And happy World Cup. I hope you have a fantastic few weeks there. Thank you for the tip. Damien, you're in Moorabbin. What are your tips?
Yes. G'day, Mary. I hope Paul is right and we do go pretty well. But, yeah, so we just come back from the US and everywhere and, like, all the advertising and people are really getting up and about, and in the airports there's a lot of people coming in.
Oh, that's interesting. So you think the World Cup fever is going to really take off in the US?
Yeah, it's really starting to heat up in the US, yeah, for sure. LA and that, they're starting to bump. Yeah,
wonderful.
So that's awesome. Thank you,
Damien, for calling. If anyone else has got their tip of what to say at a party about the World Cup, 1300 222 774. Still on the line is Dr. Andrew Ross, who's from Victoria University. Andrew, this is from Mike from Penny Royal. Please explain the dummies version of offsides in football. And actually, if you've said football, Mike, you're already three steps ahead of many people. Andrew, can you do that in 25 words or less?
Yeah, I'm glad he said football as well, because if I said soccer back home in Scotland, I'm not sure my dad would talk to me again. But So interestingly, yeah, if you're at a barbecue, or I get asked this question at a barbecue, you're able to get out the salt and pepper shakers and put them on the table to show people, which does help, because when you do that, if the ball is passed the salt and pepper shaker while the ball's being played and that attacker is ahead of the salt and pepper shaker, then they're offside. So that's in some visualization's the easiest way. to do this sort of thing. But it's because of the video assisted referee offside, you can actually see the lines. So just look at the lines when you're watching a game. Very yep. easy.
Mike, get out the salt and pepper shakers. I hope that helped. Andrew, I believe the rules have changed this year. What are the basics that we need to know?
Yeah, so there's been, FIFA have clamped down on something. So they've really clamped down on time wasting. So there's now a new 10-second substitution rule. So subs have got to get off the field pretty quickly. If throw-ins and goal kicks is a countdown as well. So if the opposition are trying to time waste, then the other team get the ball. There's the video assisted referee as well now. They're coming down on some things. So if there's a mistaken identity or an incorrect corner kick, the VAR will actually get involved with that now.
The VAR, I would suspect, will constitute a vast majority of the comments potentially at parties. Do you anticipate that?
I do. Look, the beauty about football is that anybody can understand the basics, yet lovers of the game can argue about it forever. So that's really the magic of it. But at these types of barbecues or wherever you are with family and loved ones and the heated discussions, I suspect VAR will be at the heart of it.
We're talking about the World Cup. You can't avoid it. You're listening to The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Of course, we're all by default going for the Socceroos, I think. What are the chances there, Andrew? And, if they do crash out, who else should we be going for?
Yeah, that's a good question. Look, like your callers before, I'm optimistic that I'm hoping they'll get out of the group stage. I think that's the goal, really. And look, the Socceroos they're organised under Popovich. They've got high work rate. They're a physical team, and they can put anybody under pressure. So they're in a group with USA, Paraguay, and Turkey. So it's a tough group, but look. You never know. They got out of the group stages in the last World Cup, got a really good win against Denmark. And should people remember Leckie's goal there? It was fantastic. And he's in the squad again, but probably over 80 caps he's got. So he'll probably be on the bench. But you never know. And you know, if they do crash out early, then normally what happens is you go behind one of these favourites, maybe your Spain and France, but there's a few dark horses in this tournament. You've got Norway with Haaland and Odegaard there; they could do well. Morocco made the final of the AFCON, the African Cup of Nations, so they might be good for a watch alongside Colombia as well. So they would be my recommendations to go and check those teams out.
And you've mentioned a few of those top names of people that we might want to drop those names at the barbecue that we're all apparently going to together here. Anyone else that you wanted to mention?
Well, yeah, look, there's a sort of bunch of players, really, that would be the ones to watch out for and ones to watch. Mm. So Spain have got the young teenager, Lamine Yamal, that is really a sort of teenage sensation. But they've also got Rodri and Gavi as well. So they're players that are really, obviously, blessed with talent. And the Germans have got Florian Wirtz, my team Liverpool. I've had him. He's not the best season, but hoping he'll do well at Germany. And France have got obviously Kylian Mbappe and Dembele as well. But what keeps me up at night, unfortunately, is England's chances as a Scotsman in the World Cup. And they've obviously got probably the hottest striker in the world at Harry Kane, scoring over 60 goals for club and country.
We'll all be anyone but England, potentially, at this barbecue, if that's contentious. What's the time difference going to be like watching it here, Andrew, especially when it comes to the Socceroos?
Well, we're actually blessed this time round with the time difference. So the Socceroos' first match kicks off on Sunday at 2 p.m., which is normally we're used to watching these sorts of tournaments and maybe the English Premier League or La Liga at all hours of the morning. But that's a very nice time for Australians. And then the next game against the Americans is at 5 a.m., which is really the earliest people need to get up for this World Cup.
Oh, that's okay.
Which is really good. Yeah. So it's from a time perspective. I think that's it's on our side this time around.
To finish up, Andrew, I must reflect back to you. There's a couple of texts along the lines of, I'm going off to watch paint dry. That's more satisfying, intellectually rewarding. There's a mention of corruption. There's a mention of sports washing. What's your response to people at this barbecue who say, I'm not interested? What can you do to convince them that they should be watching?
Well, look, I mean, if you just if everyone reflects back to the what the Matildas did back in 2023 and they really got the nation going, most people that sports lovers got behind the Matildas, then I would urge every sports fan to give the world's most popular game a chance here. And I understand the corruption side of it and think that it's probably one of the most politically charged World Cups in history. But once the ball is kicked and the football starts, then people understand why it's the world's most popular game then.
You think it unifies people? This world needs unifying.
I do. I think it does. And that's the slogan that football and soccer unites the world. So, yeah.
Andrew, you'll be the voice in my ear when I'm at this barbecue that we're all imagining. Thank you so much. Now I want a barbecue to go to. Thank you for calling me today. For being part of the conversation today.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Dr. Andrew Ross, sports injury researcher at Victoria University and also soccer fanatic. Will you be watching the World Cup? I'd love to hear from you as well. But also, it is the King's birthday, officially, not in reality. And, of course, there are the awards. And someone who has been very close to home here in Melbourne and Victoria is Tim Entwistle, who has been director of the Royal Botanic Gardens of Victoria. He's an internationally renowned botanist, and he has been made an officer of the Order of Australia and is giving us some time today. Thanks for joining us, Tim, and congratulations.
That's a pleasure. Oh, thank you very much.
How do you feel about the gong?
Oh, look, it's really nice, actually. I see it as not only kind of recognition for the work in botanic gardens I've done over many years, and I guess as a botanist, but what's quite nice is it's also for spruiking, basically, plants and gardens. So writing, talking, all that kind of thing, which, you know, I've really loved doing through my career.
And you've had such a long and varied career. We see you on your social media. You seem to be travelling the world. This seems like a fun job.
I know. It's a bit rough, isn't it, when you get paid to do things you like? And not only, you know, work in some fantastic botanic gardens in Melbourne, of course, and Sydney and Kew Gardens, but being most recently I've been doing a bit of travelling, leading sort of garden and landscape tours to China and Morocco. And I mean, you know, they're great places to visit, but particularly to go and see the plants.
What was the thing that made you want to become a botanist?
That's an interesting question. My grandfather used to take us for long walks around Castlemaine, actually, and that's where I sort of probably got a bit of an interest in plants. But it wasn't until I got to university and I went there to do things like maths and physics that I did a couple of subjects in botany. And I realised that was far more interesting than anything else I was doing. And I did this sort of conversion, really late life conversion into plants. So I went from there, I went into algae, got into botanic gardens. So it's been a kind of varied career in a way.
Absolutely. And as I mentioned in the intro there, you have been in the Royal Botanic Gardens, many people, the director there, I think for a decade, wasn't it? And a lot of our listeners would know you from there. How does that fit in your career when you look back? What has that meant to you, and how did that help you go forward in your career as well?
Yeah, look, I was really delighted when I came back to Melbourne Gardens and became director there, because I'd started my career as a botanist there and even doing a bit of horticulture in the early years. You know, started there as a scientist, and then to come back and look after two of the really great World Botanic Gardens, that's Cranbourne and Melbourne, and to also have that ability, to sort of come back to that ability to talk about plants and to talk about what I was doing. I really enjoyed that role as a director of a garden and being able to do a little bit more than the research, a little bit more than making the gardens beautiful, but to talk about how important plants were and just how much fun they were. I mean, that's that's the really the thing that draws people to plants, I think, is how beautiful and fun they are.
Mm. Professor Tim Entwistle has been made an Officer of the Order of Australia. You're listening to him on The Conversation Hour. Tim, you've described yourself as someone trying to get people excited about plants, and I can hear that in your voice anyway. Why do plants have such a PR problem compared to animals, maybe?
Yeah, look, we go through a bit of an inferiority complex, I think. You know, we see animals getting all that attention, the furry animals, and sometimes we think plants aren't being seen as a kind of thing they used to call plant blindness. For me, they stay still, so they don't move around as much. But nearly everyone's a gardener in some way or has a pot plant. So we actually do like them. We love growing vegetables. I think it's inherent within us. We just kind of almost take them for granted. So what I've tried to do through my life, I suppose, is to talk about the interesting stories, the fun stories, the big plants, the small plants, the beautiful ones, and, you know, just to get people to realise that they're a little bit more than just a wallpaper in the background.
Mm. And obviously you've been recognised for that ability to communicate it. When you talk about the interesting and the fun stories, give us an example. Maybe there's one standout for you of if you're wanting to get someone over the line, get them fascinated by plants as much as you, what would it be?
Well, look, there's a couple maybe. I mean, the most obvious one's the big Titan arum flower that from Indonesia, when botanic gardens have that flower, it's this thing called Amorphophallus titanum, but it's a giant, stinking, sort of rotten-smelling flower, open for just 2 days and people queue to see it. I mean, I think people just realise that flowers are not all pretty roses and primulas, that there's something, look, even if it's a little bit sinister, that attracts people in. That's kind of one side of it. And just being on this trip recently to China, where we saw the origin of plants that we grow in our garden. We did see primulas, we saw daphnes, we saw slipper orchids, and a bit of a favourite of mine at the moment, oak trees growing up almost at the Himalayas. So we saw some oak trees about knee high. And that's as big as they get. They're just amazing things.
Wow, that's amazing. Tim Entwistle is with you. We are talking to him as he has been made an Officer of the Order of Australia. You've also talked about rethinking the seasons. Can you talk to us about that? You've suggested, is it Sprinter and Sprummer?
Yeah, look, it's been an ongoing theme of mine, or sort of campaign almost, that in Australia we tend to get the seasons a bit wrong. And if you look at Indigenous seasons across Australia, they vary from 2 to 13, and that makes complete sense. You know, different parts of the country have different seasons. My biggest beef was really in about July and August, when all the wattles start to come out and people see things in the garden. They'd ring me up to the botanic garden and say, it's an early spring. And you'd go, well, it may well be, but this happens every single year. And the seasons are actually a little bit different to what we think. So we've inherited these seasons from Europe. Some places they make a little bit of sense. Some places they make no sense. I really would like people to start to celebrate our local early season, you know, particularly the wattles flowering, which is my sprinter. And then Sprummer comes a little bit later and there's a few flowering trees and things that mark that. But it's really about taking more notice of what's around us.
Taking more notice. Tim, I don't think you're going to get Sprinter and Sprummer replacing all of those beautiful songs that are about winter and summer, by the way, or at least you'll have to write those songs yourself. Just to finish off, you talk about what you want people to notice, and you've spent your career trying to get people engaged. What's one thing that you'd like to say to listeners now about what they should notice right now, today, as they're moving around their public holiday?
Yeah, look, I'd like them to take notice of I'm sitting in Barrow at the moment where it's very wintry, the leaves are off the trees. And I think the thing I would ask people to notice, no matter where they are, is that changing world around them. And that reflects some of those bigger issues we're dealing with, things like climate change, the fact that that's going to make it harder for some plants and animals to live and survive, and then therefore for us. So on a kind of more positive note, though, I just want people to notice that there is seasonal change. Every plant is doing something different. Every time you walk out that door, there's going to be something new in flower, something new in leaf, something new happening. And that's really the delight of nature and the delight of the world we live in. So let's look after it.
Professor Tim Entwistle, congratulations on your gong and good luck with that campaign to rename the seasons. I want to hear those songs from you at some stage.
You do not, but thanks very much.
Professor Tim Entwistle, Officer of the Order of Australia as of today. Michelle in Carnegie says, Dr. Tim was a great ally during our battle against Skyrail 10 years ago. He helped the community get the plantings to green and provide greater amenity in our area. Well deserved. Great to hear him on the radio. And we've also been talking about the World Cup, the cheat sheet to the beautiful game. This from Tim in the CBD. My answer to those AFL fans who bag soccer, that's okay, we'll survive. It's only the most popular sport in the world and Aussie rules is only played in half of Australia. Have a wonderful day. I'll be back again with the Conversation Hour tomorrow.